Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the Rohatasa Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha answers Rohatasa's question regarding the possibility of awakening by seeking outside of himself in an actual or figurative sense. Included in this talk is our Sangha Q&A and discussion. I have edited out our 20-minute meditation session. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you.
This morning's talk is on the Rohatasa Sutta, where the Buddha teaches mindfulness and how to apply it in a very direct way. Rohatasa asks the Buddha, is it possible by traveling to know or see or reach the far end of the cosmos, where one does not take birth and be subject to sickness, aging, and death, in short, to be free of suffering? So the cosmos in this sense really relates to samsara and wandering around in samsara endlessly experiencing dukkha. So it's really just a metaphor for ongoing dukkha. The Buddha responds, I tell you, friend, it is not possible by traveling to know or see or reach the end of the cosmos, where one does not take birth, age, die, and reappear. So the end of the cosmos is a metaphorical of escaping the effects of the phenomenal world, of escaping dukkha. In ancient terminology, the cosmos is the entire phenomenal world, including mystical mind states giving rise to visionary experiences. Again, metaphorically, the end of the cosmos means ending the stress and unhappiness of being bound to the phenomenal world. This is what has given rise in some Buddhist schools to a rich and imaginative cosmology. It is most skillful to view these different mind states for what they are, aspects of psychophysical consciousness arising from views influenced by karma and culture, also influenced by the ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Rohatasa then tells the Buddha how profound his teaching is, and despite Rohatasa's great metaphysical accomplishments, he was unable to find lasting peace and happiness. Rohatasa traveled extensively, physically and within his own mind, but never reached the end of the cosmos, the end of his own capacity for distraction. So really what this is saying is Rohatasa's spiritual search became his own distraction, because he was always looking outside of himself, always trying to find something that was beyond his own experience, which is impossible. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
Hey.
The Buddha concluded by telling Rohatasa, it is not possible to reach the end of the cosmos by seeking outside of yourself to reach nibbana. At the same time, I tell you that it is not possible to end stress, disappointment, unhappiness without reaching the end of the cosmos. So that's quite a contradictory statement, isn't it? But what he's really saying, that the answer lies within both of those, within the consideration of both of those. Yet it is within this body, with its perception and intellect, that there is the cosmos, meaning dukkha, the origination of the cosmos, clinging and craving, there is the cessation of the cosmos, and the path, and there is a path leading to the cessation of the cosmos, and that is the Eightfold Path. So it's all included in this somewhat imaginary view of the world. The dukkha of the cosmos occurs within the same body that the cessation of suffering, the cessation of the cosmos, occurs within the same body. So the Buddha is simply teaching that if you're looking outside of the body, you're looking in the wrong place. It's not found out there. The whole experience is occurring within your own body, meaning within your own mind, too. The Buddha continues, cessation, nibbana, is not to be reached by traveling to the end of the cosmos, by seeking outside of one's mind and body. Cessation is not experienced without reaching the end of the cosmos, meaning, and what he's saying here is completely understanding the cosmos, or completely understanding dukkha. When the Buddha describes awakening as it relates to that, he says that right view is a view that completely understands in a profound way dukkha. And he's saying the same thing here. Cessation is not experienced without reaching the end of the cosmos within one's own mind and body. Then there is release from suffering, stress, and unhappiness. The wise understand the cosmos and the end of the cosmos. They understand the origination and the cessation. Again, pointing right back to the Four Noble Truths. They have developed understanding of the Dhamma. Their minds are tranquil with release from views. They do not long for the cosmos, or they do not long for ongoing, continuing distraction, or any other. The Buddha is going to use the word that he always used to describe an awakened state, someone free of dukkha, is they are unbound. The example of the Buddha's own life describes this teaching perfectly. The Buddha left the palace grounds and traveled for 6 years, seeking understanding outside of himself. It was only when, now remember the Buddha's story, that he first looked to other teachers who basically taught adaptations of the Veda, and they were techniques that were taking the mind outside of himself, looking for experiences for understanding. Alara Kalama was teaching nothingness. Udaka Ramaputta, I don't know how I still remember those names, was teaching that life is neither perception nor non-perception, which is another variation of nothingness or emptiness, and the Buddha rejected both of those. And then he spent many, many years in some very severe ascetic practices. Again, that ascetic practice was thought that if you deny in an extreme way every sensory indulgence, that you'll free your body from your own mind. And of course, the Buddha found out that that's not possible either, and he's refuting that whole thought by saying it's not by escaping what is here, it's by deeply understanding what's occurring. And if you really think about that, most religions, at least in some way, are, well, I shouldn't say they're taught as an escape, but the result is often viewed as an escape. If I live my life in a perfect way, when I die, I'll go to some place as my reward. And that's common through most religions, including most of the modern Buddhist religions. Where was I? I'm going to go back this a little bit. The Buddha left the palace grounds and traveled for 6 years, seeking understanding outside of himself. It was only when he rejected his external search for understanding and used a meditation technique that brought his mind to a tranquil state. Once the Buddha's mind had settled in a tranquil state, insight arose and his mind cleared, insight to the three marks of existence. The result of his awakening is taught as the Four Noble Truths. Awakening to the teachings of the Dhamma is understanding the cause of stress and unhappiness, abandoning the cause of stress and unhappiness, clinging and craving, desire and aversion, experiencing the cessation of stress and unhappiness, and developing the path leading to the cessation of suffering, the Eightfold Path. This cannot be accomplished through external means or distracted mind states. It was a profound relief when I realized this. No longer was I wandering in a world of confusing and often competing views. I ceased looking outside and began to look inside. I began to understand that external seeking was simply another distraction in a way of seeking pleasure in acquiring views and having certain experiences. And I did that for many years. True mindfulness is being mindful of the quality of mind as life occurs. Being mindful of the present moment is not becoming fixed on an imaginary point in time. The refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path is rooted in concentration, which allows for being mindful of life as life occurs. The ongoing process of becoming. There is no need or usefulness to seek outside for this refined mindfulness and the peace and lasting happiness that arises once the veil of dukkha is lifted. So again, this whole sutta is pointing our minds and our experiences back to developing a meditation practice, a useful and effective meditation practice, within that framework of the Eightfold Path. And it's that framework of the Eightfold Path that guides our mindfulness towards not being distracted, continually distracted by the cosmos or by dukkha. It could almost be as an authentic teaching to say that instead of saying life is dukkha or there is dukkha or dukkha occurs, as there is distraction occurs, because it really is the preoccupation and the resulting distraction of dukkha that obscures reality. We become obsessed through clinging, craving and clinging to chase after what gives us pleasure and avoid anything that brings us displeasure, and you know that runs the whole gamut of human experience, rather than simply being present with life occurs. Remember, the Buddha stated when first describing suffering, he said birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, and death is suffering. Then he goes on to say that being separated from what is loved is suffering, not getting what is wanted is suffering. In short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering, and the five clinging aggregates are simply confused views that we're holding to ourselves. That creates that whole process. So in understanding that, we understand that life is an ongoing process that is often disappointing, but only often disappointing because of attachment. If we're not attached to things being any different than they are, then previously situations that would be disappointing and that we would attach ourselves to, meaning wanting them to be different, are simply occurrences. Is that clear? I think it is. But
I feel like I'm starting to really digest that and see it, how as much as we have disappointments for things that we want to be this way and that way, that we just end up making it a bigger disappointment in all these different ways I'm speaking for myself, but by, wanting to avoid the actual original disappointment and adding all this other stuff to it, and then it's like the ball of disappointment is bigger in the end when I feel like when the truth comes out or something, or because I've developed this certain level of the practice, I'm able to catch myself now and see how it got to that point, and then it's like, oh, okay, well now where did that really start, and what was the, what was the originating thing I was trying to avoid, and kind of seeing that how avoidable the rest of it was, and seeing that it was really just being distracted, like you were saying, being distracted, sometimes it's just being distracted by something that caused you not to see clearly.
Yep.
And so, I feel like I had a week of some occurrences that, I was really able to look at, use the Eightfold Path and the framework of that to help get through, the day of it all. I read most of this also. I was like, wow, that's really, often I read these things and it just fits like a puzzle, fits like a glove on what's occurring in my life right now. And I think that's the nature of the teachings, is that that's, they do. But anyway, that was kind of a little bit of a tangent, but I feel like I understand what's being said.
Yeah. So. Not a tangent, Laura. That was a beautiful explanation of it. You said that distraction doesn't allow you to see what's there. And that's the whole point. That really is. And the only way that we can maintain something that is inherently empty of its own existence, an ego personality, is by the ongoing distraction. And that's another way of saying conditioned mind. It's the ego that has a conditioned mind, which means that in reality there's nothing of substance there, except by constant distraction, it's able to maintain itself, it's able to maintain its views. And I'm not trying to give an ego personality its own type of life or power. It's by our own choice that we do that, but once we're rooted in ignorance, we no longer see the choice, and you just described the choice. You can either stay caught up in this, in the cosmos, or you can recognize it and abandon it. And
being able to reflect after that. Because I was having a conversation with somebody just about, and as I was having the conversation, it was like I barely understood what I was saying, but sometimes I just have to start saying the words and then reflect. But it was like, how is it that we have so many fantasies about what things are going to be? And then, as you move along, you realize that it had nothing to do with reality. Like, I was just, it sort of hit me. I try not to beat myself up for it, but it was just like, it's the utter humiliation. Like, how did I really, I know, but yet I got caught up and this is nothing major, changing anything, but, very small things, but still, the difference between the actual reality and then the fantasy, which is often these projections as to what somebody else is going through, or what you think about somebody else, or that, when it's really all about what you, it's you,
all your
ego.
Views.
And so, yeah, I just, it was really kind of a week of just, you know, having, in reflection, having some level of clarity as to that process, which is like, wow, it's so subtle when that happens.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm like totally disillusioned by life for so long. I've been like on another, you know, planet, and just the humiliation of being like, wow, that's what I was walking around. Like, that is, you know, anyway.
You're also describing what it feels like to awaken. Just like from a dream, you finally realize, wow, I'm not seeing the
I was, we'll see if like, it's passing kind of.
Well, but
it's
first,
easy to fall back into being totally, you know, blinded in the world we live in. I mean, and with the, that's what I feel like I might have these moments of, and these glimpses of like seeing through, you know, the cloud or whatnot, but life comes at you, and it's a lot to process in this pace that we're living in. I find that meditation is so important to come back and quiet yourself so that you, I mean, I really, anyway.
Yeah, that's why it's taught.
You know.
We need that refuge, that ongoing refuge, to separate ourselves from that whole. It's like we're born into an endless funhouse ride, and all that we see is inside that funhouse, and we have no other perspective to see. And then somebody opens a window that was always closed, and you start noticing maybe there's something different. And you keep getting stuck in that funhouse again, and you see the window again, and maybe there's something outside. Well, the window is like the Dhamma. We start getting a different view, a different way of seeing ourselves in relation to the world. And eventually we can say, wait a minute, maybe this isn't all that there is. Let me jump through that window. And you see that there's a whole new existence for yourself and how you can relate by just going through the window. But you first have to recognize you're stuck in the funhouse. And the funhouse is great. It's a constant distraction. There's all new things to see around every corner. Sometimes it's frightful. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's just pleasurable. But it's all part of a funhouse. But until you realize that, until you have, again, getting back to conditioned thinking, it's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. So we can recognize we're stuck in a funhouse. The name doesn't imply that it's all fun. We need a way to get out. And you described it beautifully. And in the beginning, you said after the fact, too, let me be picking apart your words, you used some profound words. It's after the fact that we're first able to recognize it. It's after we go by the window that we realize, wait a minute, there's another way. And you have to see that first. You have to be where you are. Put yourself in the right plane of understanding or the right level of mindfulness before you can move out of it. You first have to recognize you're stuck. You're stuck in samsara. You're stuck in the cosmos. And you can't get there by analyzing the entire funhouse. You can't get there by hoping to get to the end of the ride and then it'll be clear. You got to get off the ride. You got to jump off. And you can jump off. It's another, you know, using all these euphemisms and metaphor this morning. You can jump off. You can gain the ability and the courage to jump off because we have a refuge. We know we're jumping into a refuge. We know that another human being has done this. He told us how we can jump off, and we have the support of a Sangha to do it too. We're not doing it we're not jumping into a void. We're jumping into something that we know, at least on an initial level, is likely to develop it because somebody else already did it.
And the momentum is going to drag you back.
Yeah.
As a spinner around, you're going to be out there going, get sucked back in when you don't want it to happen.
So you've been on funhouse rides.
Yes.
Yeah, they're hard to get. I mean, when you're a little kid, you don't want to get off at all, do you? Or the roller coaster or anything. I want to stay on here. My poor parents.
I have to share this crazy dream that I had, like, a few nights ago. It was last weekend, I think. And because I've heard you say wander around in samsara so many times, but and I understood what it meant, like, intellectually. But I had this dream that it was like in the dream I was kind of where I was like 10 years ago, but I didn't have any frame of reference. I didn't have anything that's in my life superficially now. I was, everything was the same, you know, I had the same job and the same house, but I was not doing any of this practice, and I was just doing the same kind of thing that I was doing then, which was like going out and partying and playing music and drinking too much and, you know, just chasing sensation, sensory pleasure stuff. And I was, in the dream, I was just like really unfulfilled, and I had this strong sense of just being very unfulfilled, and I was thinking about how I could somehow get myself happier, and all I could think about to do that was more drinking or partying or hanging out with the wrong kind of people.
Associations.
And I was, it was like I was 10 years, it was like there was none of this framework was in the dream or in my mind in the dream. And then all of a sudden this thought came into my head where I was like, you need to change your karma. And then I woke up and I was like in my bed, and I was like, I got up, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I like got up and was like dancing around the house. It was almost like I saw my, and then while I was dancing around the house, I was like,
that's beautiful.
That's really cool.
It's describing it beautifully, the
yeah.
samsara, you know, that just getting caught up in that compulsive type of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's always something external that's going to make me happy.
Right.
And it's nothing that, it can never make you happy. It can continue distraction, you know, that next drink or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
You feel good. You feel good because you're distracted, not because there's any reality there.
Mm-hmm.
And to see it, you know, but it's such a difficult thing to pierce that veil of samsara, of dukkha, of ongoing karma without knowing what we're creating. And I think it's one of the major difficulties. The question about that, about, I don't even know how to phrase this correctly. I've been thinking a lot about it, though. The question that most people that have been coming to class and online ask in many different ways, but it all retains to, well, what happens when I let go of craving, clinging, desire? Don't I need it? Don't I need to have my ego, my self-referential ego, involved in things to really have a life, to have a life experience? It seems like letting go of all the things that contribute to dukkha is annihilation of life itself. But all that it's doing is letting go of views that can only lead to more confusion, delusion, and suffering, wandering in samsara. Then we can wake up and we can dance in joy because we know that the answer is within us. And that's, again, I think you would experience, it's not something, even though you might have learned it here from me or it doesn't really matter, you realize that it's up to you to get out of it. There's nothing imposed on it, but what an incredible, incredibly powerful understanding. I can still remember when I got the glimpse of it. I didn't really get the whole thing, but when I got this glimpse that it's got nothing to do with all these other things. It's got to do with what I do. And if I can apply myself in a way, which I didn't quite know then I can achieve that state. And then I realized, well, yeah, all you got to do is follow this path. It's just great realizations. You're talking about how this works in a very direct way, so thank you. Any other questions or comments? Diane?
I was in following along with that. The thing that I think is kind of, well, a part of my brain says funny or amazing or something, is that when you make that choice, all the other trappings, the glit, you know, of all the other things, just everything, it gets simple, it gets plain, it gets base, it doesn't need a doily under a vase, or it doesn't even need the vase, it doesn't even need the table, it's okay, and even eating, I don't need sauces, or I mean, just plain, basic it just gets down to plain and simple. And I keep thinking, wow. I mean, talk about the fantasy land or the fun thing. I mean, the world is throwing at you. You need this. You need to have all of these things. You need to have this type of a house, and it needs to be needs. And when and taking care of the body is a, I mean, one thing I found out yesterday, I mean, I didn't find out, but I don't drink enough water some days. And I, my body really tells me that. But that's a simple thing. I don't need Diet Pepsi. I don't need a power drink. I just need water. How basic. And that's to me what meditation is becoming, is the water to bring it all down into the simplicity of it. And the, my ego says, oh, but I like all those things. And it's what I think is really fun is to say, that's just, those things just mean more work. It's more fun just keeping it simple.
It is.
I don't know.
Well, it's only in an ego personality that complicates life. Life isn't complicated because it's just what's occurring. It's when we think that it needs to be different or try to figure out what has already occurred and why it occurred in my life that it becomes complicated. When we can just accept this is what's here. There's no complication because it's just what's going on. I mean, and that's not to say there's not some subjects that are complicated to understand, sending a rocket to Mars or you know, whatever it might be, but that's not the Dhamma. We're not trying to figure out all those things. Remember Tuesday's talk about going to the end of the, I mean, establishing a self in the future, the past, etc. Those are all complicated ideas that they're just not worth contemplation because it takes us out of the present moment. This is a simple and direct practice, but our minds are so complicated that many of us struggle with it. I did too at first, but then you start getting glimpses of understanding or a dream that leads you in the right way, and you realize how simple and direct it is. And it's all rooted in that, in a meditation practice that's a true refuge and actually develops a quiet mind rather than something else. You know, that's so important to deepen that concentration at first. Again, I don't mean to use you as so much an example this morning, but if you didn't deepen your concentration, you would have never seen this process occurring in your own mind. And you also needed the framework of the Eightfold Path to see it. It just tells you, the Eightfold Path says, look here, don't look there. This is where your reality lies. Stop looking outside of yourself. It's what the Buddha was teaching Rohitasa. Stop looking outside of yourself. Deepen your concentration. And there's a backstory to this whole story that I didn't get into, but well now. Rohitasa was recognized as one of the great spiritual masters of his time. And yet in his own understanding, when he came across the Buddha, he said, wait a minute, I don't know anything. Maybe he was still holding on to it when he had this conversation with the Buddha, but the Buddha set him right. You are, in essence, he's saying, you're a brilliant person, Rohitasa, but you're just looking in the wrong places. You know, when I say something like that, I think back to this teacher I had many years ago, Arnold Patton, who used to say that, it's one of the one things I remember from him. He said that if you're in New York and you want to go to Chicago, but you think you're in Los Angeles, you can't get there. Why? Because you're looking in the wrong place. You don't have a base in which to start your search. It's just endless then. You know? There's no point of reference. The Eightfold Path is the point of reference. So.
I think, John, that I'm in the funhouse and I keep looking outside the window and I get frustrated that I keep going in the funhouse. I keep, you know, which is what we're talking about. You know?
Yeah.
And a lot of it's habit. It's just your own habits that you have in life.
Mm-hmm. So the way out is to recognize you're in the funhouse and be okay with it. Mm-hmm. Enjoy the ride while you're still on the ride and know that it's going to end.
I think that is so key, is to say, okay, I'm an ego now, and I fight it. and just say, okay, this is what's going on. And I mean, that in a sense is like a hallelujah. I got it. I see my ego, and not fight it, and not beat myself up about it. That, you know, the constant be gentle with yourself is to suddenly be gentle with ego and say, it's okay. It's okay.
But it's not okay.
Well, no, but it is okay. Because you'll see it eventually.
We know different. We know different.
Fighting it.
But
builds
we
it.
Can't, you know, I know, I understand John's words. You know, I absolutely, well, I think I understand them. But changing into that world, changing into that view, not going on fun rides in your imagination or in your life or taking things on in your life just to make your life more interesting, or and all these things that we do, just stop it. It's very, very hard.
It is. That's why I always say be gentle with yourself, which also means accept that you're still on a ride, but also be mindful that there's a way to get off, and you have to develop. That's up to yourself to develop that. And you're doing that. I'm not saying you're not.
Yeah,
and again, that's part of it too.
Forward than it was 6 months ago or something like that.
I think that
happens.
I think that it's natural to have those. I don't know. I mean, I think that when you feel that way, you know, find the place where you can accept it. And before you know it, as long as you stick with your practice, and before you know it, you're going to have a reflection where you see that you're actually a little bit further along than you were. I mean, maybe it's just something of a little bit of faith, you know, in yourself, that you actually are doing it, and that feeling that you're having is just part of the phenomenal world. Like you're experiencing frustration and disappointment, and that's just part of what you need, where you need to be. Like, and it might, I think we're all really different. We all have different experiences in life, so we all have different things that come up for us stronger than others, and things to work through on, you know, that might keep reoccurring in different ways. And so if that's what's coming up, then just stay with it. But it's, you know,
well,
and I feel like I've experienced that feeling of thinking, you know, how could I have put this much time into something and then I still feel the same, or I'm all of a sudden back where I thought I started. But it's, I don't know if that's, I think that's just a view that you're having of yourself that's not really reality.
Yes, and it's the view itself that shows that you've developed, because you have to have developed the Eightfold Path to have the view that there's still more to go. And even having that feeling of being uncomfortable in some way, however you're applying it to yourself, even if it's in a negative way, like, you know, I'm just not getting it, or this is too hard, or whatever that might be, that's all part of the process too. And that can be helpful. Maybe next week I'll teach this, if I can remember what. The Buddha often describes the danger of being stuck in samsara. And there's a sutta where he talks that we should be engaging in the Dhamma like our hair's on fire. I mean, that's a pretty good picture of how important this is, and how the internal motivation should be developed. That, yeah, this is the most important thing we can do, but also recognizing that there is something to do. You need to get off the ride. That whole idea of samsara is being stuck on the ride. It seems like we can't get off, and everything we do is bringing us back, is sticking us, is clinging us to the ride. But that, just that quick glance of the window that's there, you never saw it before, is the opening. And so you keep developing the Eightfold Path. That's all we can do.
What's important of this gentleness thing is, I mean, my ego saying, get, you're not doing it right.
Yep.
You're in samsara. So get out of it. And my ego thinks, well, I can pick up this cushion and put it there. Therefore, I should be able to instantaneously decide to get out of samsara.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, where the gentleness thing comes in. And fighting ego, saying, what is the matter with you, you stupid jerk? You see it?
Yeah.
Why don't you just get it and get out of it? And that's where the gentleness to just relax and let it be and know that it will come. But let it come. It's not something that I can egotistically say. I mean, shoot, if we could egotistically awaken, become enlightened, the whole world would, you know, you could just say, I am now enlightened. Ta-da! And...
yeah, yeah.
And,
anyway.
Okay.
But I am what you've just described, you know, that I get it. I understand it, so why don't I do it?
Let it.
You do it, Lorna. What are you doing here?
I mean, answer that question. Just answer that question to yourself. Why
don't I do it? Oh, well, here, the answer is conditioned thinking.
Yeah, I know.
And you're still suffering from conditioned thinking. And it's only that conditioned thinking that says, I'm stuck and I can't get out.
I know. And I feel like I've absorbed as much as I can absorb, and I'm stuck.
It's okay.
Oh, so I understand what you're saying, that you're concerned because you right now you don't feel like there really is a way out because you've done it all.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's two, well, one's a teaching, one's just an observation. One is to understand, and I've talked about Ananda, who is the Buddha's cousin and attendant. Well,
I wouldn't be a Nampus.
Well, but what he didn't want to be him either, and it wasn't until he accepted, in a rather reactionary way, it wasn't until he accepted who he was that he was able to change it. And there's an implication if you read some of the questions that Ananda gave to the Buddha, you can almost see his own projection of himself, rather than accepting himself as he was. He was trying to present himself even to the Buddha as further advanced than he was. And the Buddha's response was often, you're not there yet, but keep going. In the when I teach dependent origination, I usually teach it from what is called the Paticca Samuppada Sutta, the shorter discourse on dependent origination. There's a longer discourse called the Mahanidana that one of these days I'll teach. And it starts with Ananda saying, hey, Buddha, I think I really got this. And the Buddha says, in a rather long way, he says, uh-uh, you don't have it yet. You still have some more to go, and this is what you should do. And what he points him back to is the Dhamma. So if you look at that in a realistic way, we can take refuge in even that little teaching to recognize that even someone who was with the Buddha 24/7 didn't get it instantly. Some people did, like Khandana at the first teaching. And it doesn't matter. It's only the ego self that says, I need to get it now. Look at all those folks. They got it. And here I am still wandering in samsara. That's an ego view. A wise view is, I have the teachings. It's just up to me. And what difference does it make how long it takes? And then the teachings I was going to point to is the understanding of the three marks of existence, of impermanence, not self, and the resulting dukkha is important. Because then we can understand that each and every moment, if I maintain my mindfulness, each and every moment holds the potential to get off the ride, to get out of samsara. And that's all that matters. The thought that I'm stuck is a confining thought, and it can only reinforce itself. And I'm not saying you shouldn't have it, but the only thing to do is to recognize that this is where I am right now and understand that this is not where I need or I will be in the future. Everything changes. And we've been given a very clear and distinct path on how to continue to direct our minds towards awakening. But, and you're describing this beautifully, when we get stuck in the idea, one of the five hindrances is doubt in relation to the Dhamma. When we get stuck in that, it can really put an end to our Dhamma practice. Why the Buddha taught it. And he didn't teach it like, well, you shouldn't have doubt because you should believe me without any type of real experience. But he did say, this is the path.
take it to yourself, develop it yourself, and have the experience, then you'll know. And so you do know because you've had the experience. Your mind state right now says, I'm stuck. But that's just an opinion. It's a view. Eva?
And obviously the Buddha learned from his folks around him, his Sangha, because he was able to have all these different suttas that apply to all these different situations because everybody was having those same problems. And so, because like Laura said, you know, when I, you know, just as I'm about to have a question, then something happens and the answer's right there. You don't really have to look that far. And so all the legwork's been done, all the questions have been asked and the answers have been placed there. And so the hard part, that's why it's so simple and yet so difficult, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we do have, this, we're smart and we can understand things intellectually and are pretty, you know. And then it's, you know, and we have access to the teachings, you know, which, you know, is, we're really lucky to have that. It wasn't, you know, we didn't have to, like, travel, you know, weeks and months with no, you know, food to get to the teachings. They're right here on our phones. And,
so
I feel like if you are, because you're saying that you come here and you start to get it and then you go home and you're, like, back on the carnival ride. So that sounds like you recognize that you're choosing distraction.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So if you're choosing the distraction and you see yourself choosing the distraction, right there, you're judging yourself. If you're saying, oh, I'm choosing this stupid distraction, but you know what, I'm going to do it anyway. Do it. Engage in the distraction and really experience the distraction and say, am I really enjoying this? Do I really like this? Really look at it. Really be present with your distraction.
Is it fulfilling?
Is it really fulfilling? And with no judgment, with no like, okay, yes, I know it's going to make me feel great. Yes, I know this ice cream is going to make me feel amazing. And now I'm already at the end of the ice cream experience. Like, eat the ice cream and be with the ice cream and say, am I really enjoying this? Yeah, I am. Or no, I'm not. Or just look at it. Just notice it and be there and notice it. And then I feel like that might help you loosen it up.
Yeah. And the thing with the ice cream is that with the ice cream is that you have the ice cream and you enjoy it and then it's done and then you have to have another ice cream to enjoy it.
There's the problem.
To keep on that same enjoyment.
If you're
aware about it, then you will always keep looking for the same thing because it's never really going to be what you thought it was.
And that's just a conditioned view of that particular... just a conditioned view of that. I feel like referring to the... going back to the Eightfold Path in these moments where we're, you know, being conscious of our choices can help, or even not in the moment, but after, just going, what I find myself doing, like, what was my intention? Like, what, where was my view at that moment, you know? And I don't always have an answer, because I, you know, I don't always spend too much time deliberating about it, but just sometimes it's like, oh, I can see my intention was actually selfish. My intention was, you know, just to feel better for myself and, or, you know, whatever it was. And I find that really helpful. And it inevitably just keeps coming up again.
You're describing right intention. The intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. That's how we apply it. I think we should all leave here and go down to Ow Wow Cow for some ice cream.
I mean, it's
my main distraction. It's really something that I do use that and drinking have been the two things that I'm like, am I really enjoying this? You know, or I, you know, am I not? No.
Yeah,
it's one distraction that I can't, like,
Yeah, there were times in my life where I was laying on the floor with an empty bowl and an empty bottle, thinking, you know, this is wonderful. You know, my perceptions were a bit off.
When it says that the answers are inside, that's what keeps me. Sometimes I don't want to meditate because, especially if I've gone through a period of where all kinds of shit has come up, things, incidents, parts of my life that I just would rather forget and don't like. And to me, that's where, when they say that meditation is not for...
Well, I say that. It's a practice of ease and joy, but not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, of heart, because when I look at some of the things that I've done and lived through, but the point of it is, when those things come up, to allow myself, to let myself feel those feelings, to experience the incident. And sometimes it takes a day, a couple hours, or a day, or 2 days, and feel those feelings, and then it's gone. The incident may still be there, but all of the power that had over me, that was sabotaging me, that was making me feel little and not allowing me to love who I am or to be, is gone. And that's the hard part to me. Of meditate to keep meditating. Am I never going to be done with all of this stuff that's inside of me that I didn't want to look at, that I was ignorant about, that I made mistakes, that I hurt somebody, that I was hurt, all of those things that come up.
I think when I'm mature enough or awake enough or whatever, but I'm beginning to see. All that you've described is a thought. It's just a thought.
Yeah.
And just, I can, anything in meditation, I'm working on life. When you have thoughts that are not wise, or thoughts that lead you to distraction, I can see it's just a thought. And it's, as I think I said last week, that another thought will be coming on in another moment. Just let it go. It's just a thought. It's not something you have to act on. It's not something you have to do. It's just a thought that's coming to your mind, and it'll go, and another one will come along, and that's life. So I don't dwell on things that come up in meditation. I'm trying to sort of be choosing. I should say all this for afterwards. You're going to ask your answer all afterwards, but sort of choosing wisely in my day which thoughts are good thoughts and which thoughts are just stuff that comes in your head. I'm sort of being, hopefully, trying to be mindful enough to choose the thoughts that are really engaged in life, and not thoughts that take you off or just keep you going on the funhouse type stuff. Mind just goes on and on because you're in the funhouse. So I'm trying to be mindful of those good thoughts.
Yeah, and I think you are. What we're all talking about, I think, is getting past the conceptualization stage of what this should be like and what our lives should be like and what the Dhamma is like, and developing the actual experience, which is what the Buddha consistently said, Ehipasika. You have to come and see for yourself. And we're all doing that. Eva said something about the Buddha first taught the Four Noble Truths. And then most of the other suttas were situational, meaning he was teaching something in relation to the situation that had arisen, and pointing that back to the Four Noble Truths. He didn't teach, every teaching wasn't the Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold Path. It was based on a situation that was occurring. This was his encounter with Rohatasa. All the other ones, the Salata Sutta was something else that you were describing. Nearly every one is that way. Some of them were prepared teaching. But most of the suttas that the Buddha gave were spontaneous and situational, in relation to what was occurring in front of him. And that's what we've talked about this morning, too. What a great class. As we were going around, I was thinking maybe to change the structure of the class, and instead of doing a talk and meditation and going around, maybe I'll give a talk and we'll go around and meditate. So I think that's what we've done today. But we haven't heard from Anthony.
I'm just sitting back enjoying it. I think Lauren is far ahead of where she thinks she is. Because the fact that she can see that she's in the fun house means that she recognizes. Mm-hmm. And most people don't know there is a fun house and don't know they're in the fun house.
That's key. Yeah, you have to know.
And so if you, even if you're acting skillfully one time out of 99, you're still further ahead than everybody else in the funhouse.
That's right.
And I mean, life is designed to pull us in. It's only been amplified by, you know, the news and social media and things like that. But, you know, if the only way you can't be constantly pulled in, maybe, well, that's not even a way, but the one of the better ways to live a more skillful life would be to put yourself in a Buddhist monastery. But that's not practical for most of us.
Yeah, that's the easy way.
So, you know,
nice if you can do it. But.
Yeah. So you just have to recognize that these times come along, and you know that you're gonna, you may come here one Saturday and think you did something really great by extracting yourself from a negative talk, and then walk out of here, and the next thing you know, you're in one.
Yeah.
That's the way it's gonna be.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, hopefully this is a place of refuge when we come here.
You know, I had a trial come up last week, and I was being harsh on myself. I said, why is it that, right, you know, when a trial comes up, my heart starts racing, and I can't sleep. And I'm not, you know, I'm 26 years practicing law, so I'm not scared to go to trial. But I get this adrenaline thing, and I get my throat closes a little anxiety. And then I just said, you know what, instead of being angry at myself for having this, I should praise God, or whatever spiritual, you know, being there is, that I have been given this gift to be pumped up when I need to be pumped up.
Yeah.
That's fight or flight response is designed. That's when you're supposed to have it, you know, when we're not slaying saber-toothed tigers anymore. So trial is the closest thing I get to that.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I shouldn't be angry at that. I should be thankful. This is what it's designed for. And when I felt that way, it actually went down.
Yeah, it's just okay. Yeah, it helps you focus. It develops a proper mindfulness for what's occurring. So, yeah, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know? There's a lot of people that say that. Like, you've heard actors have said that, you know, especially stage actors. Or they might be well accomplished, but they'll say, I'm always, you know, nervous when I get on stage, or public speakers, or athletes, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's once the closing is over, I'm completely comfortable. I mean, the opening. Once I do my opening, I'm completely comfortable. But up to that time, I get a little racy.
Yeah, I still do. You know, when I give talks about this or that, I've been doing it for years and years, but I still get that first 2 or 3 minutes. You know, it always feels the same.
We're not going around the room?
I guess we are.
Oh, okay.
No, well, maybe we will, because we always do. Maybe I'll change this theme to work. I mean, we just naturally fell into the going around the room today. So.
Yeah, because I have something I want to talk about, but I'll save it. I don't want to. I need to meditate.
All right, so yeah, let's meditate, and then we'll go around the room.
Awakening and enlightenment can really be a part of our life throughout the day. That's my hope.
Sounds good.
I think I can.
Thank you. Lorna.
Well, first of all, I know I'm very grateful for the Buddha's teachings and the council that how many years, you know, 100 years later and 100 years after that, the writings and things. However, and today was a good example, that the bits you interject about the teachings, I think, are as much a learning opportunity for me. Like, as the Buddha's teachings, like when you would describe the fun house and we're going round and we're all, you know, and then we look out the window and we go around again. And I think that's so useful for me to understand what's going on in my head as the Buddha's teaching. So I'm glad that you really understand them as well as you do, and you're as knowledgeable as you are. And you can teach us, the way you teach us is, you know, the way you do it counts for a lot. The Buddha's teachings is one thing, but John Haskell teaching Buddha's teachings is another one. So I just want to say that up front.
Thank you.
As I said earlier, what I'm working on is just being aware that a thought is a thought. I don't have to act on it, it's just a thought. Trying to be mindful of which thoughts I follow in my life and which thoughts to just meditation is consistent, but not very deep. Partly because I'm ridiculing myself of how I'm progressing with the Dharma practice, probably. I'm probably adding to my own dukkha, which is coming out of my meditation. I've had these meditations that I've had there.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. And meditation doesn't need to be deep. It does need to be consistent, and you're doing that. That's the important thing. Again, I've never come across a teaching from the Buddha where he says you have to have deep meditation. Mm-hmm. He said, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, and engage in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, period. Never put a quality on meditation, never. But he described the results in describing the jhanas, that's all. You know, just to recognize that, but not as something that we should be seeking. So you're developing all that very well. You were going to say something else.
I was just going to say that I judge, well, that's not the right way to put it, but I can't think of a more skillful way of putting it. So I judge my meditation.
It is medication.
How quickly I realize that I'm thinking and not meditating. Yeah. You know, and sometimes there's a thought and a thought, a thought, a thought, a thought, and the whole train of thoughts. And I'm sitting thinking, and then I think, I should be meditating.
But that's meditation.
Yes,
recognizing that you're thinking is part of the process.
But the more concentrated and more skillful you are at the time, you recognize that earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that because I've had. Been doing this a while, and you learn where you are in your own mind.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I've been less distracted about life at other times of my life than I am just now. Put it that way. So, but that's
meditation. That's a practice. That's the way it is.
Saying that every moment comes along, and every moment is an opportunity to move forward and change, and so on.
Yeah.
What's happening now
won't
last forever.
It won't, and nothing will. Thank you. Thank you. And just to get back to what your praise of me as a teacher, I do appreciate it. It's nice to hear, but most importantly because it reaffirms what I've learned. So the only reason I can teach what I teach is because I studied what the Buddha taught. And that has changed everything for me, so that's what I teach. And the reason I had a conversation a couple days ago with one of the online students, and he's new, and he was talking, well, how come this teacher teaches this and that teacher teaches that? And he actually gave a long list of modern teachers and some going back, and they all claim to be teaching the Buddhist teachings. How did that develop? And the simple answer is that you can't really teach what the Buddha taught unless you study what the Buddha taught. And to some people that seems obvious, to some people they don't really get that. But you can't study other forms and other developments and other teachers and expect to teach something that the Buddha taught unless they actually studied the Buddha's teaching. And unfortunately, many modern teachers and many modern applications don't go back to what the Buddha... That's fine. We should be more clear about that. But that's really what the case is. You have to study what the Buddha taught to teach what the Buddha taught. But he said that consistently during his time, too. There was a natural tendency to want to incorporate all these different teachings into it. And it's not helpful. But it is simply just what occurs, you know. And it doesn't make other teachers illegitimate, except that's how that occurs, you know. You can't learn anything unless you study it. You can't learn the basics of rocket science by going to auto mechanic school. They're both schools, you know, but it's a different learning you're going to get out of it. So that's all. What a great class. Let's finish with, there was an announcement or two. I have an online streaming Dhamma class on Wednesdays at noon. You can find information on my on Cross River Meditation. Also, I put up another one called DhammaStream.com that has the information on that. And there'll be others. We are going to start a 10-week Truth to Happiness course here like we did last year over the holidays, starting, I think, December 13th, but I'll put it out in the newsletter and ending, depending on weather, by the end of February, weather permitting too. Our next Donna dinner is November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week at Love and Oven. There's some flyers out there. There's a form on the website that if you could volunteer to clean up or set up a list of gifts that's coordinated by Maura. So I hope you can all come and spread the word about the Donna dinner. And I think that's it. So let's finish with metta. Find your relaxed meditative posture again. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. As soon as I pull it up. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing and gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is no longer born into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.